KellerKellerOfficial.com.
You need the Kellervision app. 24/7 mini documentaries, podcasts, live shows, DJ live streams, top fives, subscription packages, plus products for all your podcasts and street culture sports. Download it from the App Store for free today.
Instagram UK Frontline.
Beatbox created.
Killer Keller.
And we're here to talk about world music and street culture.
Killer Keller Podcast.
Well, life's a celebration, isn't it?
It is a celebration, just like every good chocolate in a box. Ladies and gentlemen, Killer Keller Podcast, live and direct, central London, as central as you need to be. Serves you right. Thank you for joining. Sharing is caring, you know what it is. Big shout out to graffitikings.co.uk. Hold tight, everyone's got the Kellervision app, sport and art, free download, you know what it is. We have a guest and a good friend of mine that...
Bro, let's just interject there. That was the smoothest intro you've ever done. And I kind of just want to fuck it up.
No, I just want to... Yeah, yeah. Stop getting it right.
No, I like it. Keep going, man.
The mighty heavy artillery and top of the top boy, arrow inside the place.
That's right.
What are you saying?
I'm saying all sorts of things. What should we say? What should we say?
Where to begin? Where to begin? Setting the world.
No, I'm happy to be back on. I think you've been doing some really interesting interviews. I keep up with them. I like them.
Yeah. I'm always surprised about who and how far they stretch. I mean, you know, being the South Coast.
It's a bit of texture, isn't it? It's like, I like how you keep getting different people. It's not just graph, and I think that's what's interesting. Mm. I think that it's important for all of us to, you know, there's loads of stuff I've learned about different people and different things, you know. How useful that information is. It's just entertainment, isn't it?
Yeah, it's true. And the conversation does diversify with every episode. I feel like it's the chops are getting cut, and it's just more refined, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm ready for a much more quizzical interview this time. You know, last time you were allowing me just to waffle on. I'm ready for you to cut in more this time.
Yeah, so as you probably guessed, we have done this before multitude of times, but this particular time was I think it was like podcasts within the first 100 it was. I think it was two.
Yeah, it was definitely in my first 100 podcasts. I think it was my second one.
Yeah, ever. And did you enjoy it that time?
Yeah.
Hence why he's here again.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. For those of you who don't know, I've been living in a rock, Arrow is a premier graffiti writer from the UK, globally taking it all over the shop and leaving damage all within his in his midst. Heavy Artillery, Network Terror. Give me some more. MSK?
Yeah, I was in MSK for a while. No, not anymore. Not anymore. There was some politics went on which I couldn't agree with, and therefore I can't be loyal to a situation I don't feel is being loyal to people within that. And that's, I think, the most diplomatic way I can be about that without saying anything inflammatory or
editingable.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not like that. You know, it's like we had a really good run with MSK. That was cool, and now that's come to a natural end.
Yeah,
but that was about 5 or 6 years, it's probably about 6 years ago I stopped writing that.
Yeah, I know.
So, yeah, it's much longer ago than people think.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's deceiving.
You know, people still say to me, oh, I haven't seen no MSK pieces recently.
Well, I think you said that in Brighton, some people just be shouting out their vans, paint white vans, MSK.
I mean, it really makes you wonder how it's crossed across, isn't it? Yeah, like, yeah, totally. Who's picked up on this message? A load of tradies from Brighton.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
But I think that's the beauty
commercial
of it,
crossover.
Isn't it? Yeah.
A lot has happened since we last met. I mean, first of all, for those that are listening and watching, there has been a lot lockdown.
A lot of people took notice of. I didn't particularly. But
yeah,
some
I know.
People liked
I don't
it.
Think we did because actually, I went to Brighton for the day.
Yeah, and we hung out.
Yeah, we hung out. I put a suit on and everything because I needed to look like I was going for some business or something. Do you remember? Mm. Pretty much, I was only like a suitcase short of an office worker, and that was good fun.
Yeah, well, you know, it affects people different ways, doesn't it? Like everything.
Yeah.
So. You know,
you had your teeth done. For those, that
I have. Yeah.
For those that ain't watching and are listening, there is a rack, two racks of gold teeth.
Yeah, and that's connected to Norm, in fact. And part of it was because I'd always had a gold tooth since the very early 90s. So the gold teeth was nothing new for me. Mm. And then Eric Norm, I prefer Rest to call him peace. Eric because obviously he's my close friend. Support, so if I mention Eric, I'm talking about Norm from MSK. He had all of his bottom teeth done by these guys in Germany.
Wow.
And when he'd had them done, he came straight from Germany to my house and I was like, bro, those teeth are sick.
Really?
Like they were ridiculous.
Dude, they pop.
And he, what, my ones?
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Great.
Thanks.
Carry on, Edward. Sorry.
So he's watching him shine in the lights. Eric turned up with these teeth, and he said, "Yeah, the guys in Germany are really cool. They said, you know, you can, they'll do yours if you want to get more." And I'm like, "Bro, I've got to get more done." So anyway, then we carried on and all different stuff, and then obviously the tragedy happened, and Eric passed away. And then, you know, I was just thinking, "Oh well, that's that." You know, I've lost my friend, and then out of the blue, the German guys contacted me and said, "Listen, we're still on a." Everything that was arranged. So we're the guys that are going to do them and we'll do your teeth for you. So I was like, I can't believe it. So what's come of Eric's passing is I've now got this really fond and good bond with these guys from Essen. You know, so I'm friends with the hip hop dentist and the Pop Boys tattoo guys, which are the were the connection to the dentist. So, you know, I went there and had all my teeth drilled out and that we were just laughing. Like I went in several phases and had them, you know, bits done at a time, and each time I go, it's not mad enough. More, it's
really,
not mad enough. Yeah. So in the end, I've got 22 now, all permanent. They don't come out. That's it. They're
unmovable.
So, and be honest with you, they're better than my teeth I had before.
Yeah.
Feel like your normal teeth. Yeah.
Really, really
feel exactly the same. I didn't think we'd be talking about this, but it's quite interesting. I mean, I suppose a lot of people, you know, there are people out there that have a grill or a clip on, but I just was like, I can't be bothered.
Okay, so I think the questions that most people would be asking right now is, right, what was the pain threshold? How bad was it?
There were bits of it that were very painful. I mean, naturally, having some of them are veneered and some of them are full, like caps, you know, like drill downs, but obviously everyone's been to the dentist. It's just varying degrees of that misery, you know, and it's not pleasant, but you know, once they're done. But the funniest thing is when you have them drilled down, you'd go there on like a Monday in Germany, have a whole chunk of them drilled down. They'd make you a set of plastic ones, temporaries, and you'd have to wear them all week. So I'd then go off painting with Atom and all these crazy guys from Germany doing all these trains and all mad shit. With plastic teeth. then on the Friday, the hip-hop dentist had messaged me and go, "Hey, your teeth are ready. You want an appointment tomorrow?" And you're like, "Yeah." And you go, "Okay, 6 a.m. And you're like, "Bro, who goes to the dentist at 6 a.m?
Still out.
So the guy is so cool. And it's like, you know, you go to his studio and then you say, "Oh, I can't do 6 a.m. He's like, "Okay, 9:30 tomorrow night. So you turn up and it's like this studio would be completely empty and you put on rap music and, you know, it's just cool. And you go in there with all your friends and you just go in and then they like do proper dentist shit, but with all your pals in the room. It's cool. It's really cool.
That is the coolest thing I've heard.
And it's a really nice environment, even though what you're having done is kind of painful, but it makes it cool. I mean, I went with ACT UP one time, you know, the younger guy that I do a lot of paintings with, spray ups on Instagram. Yeah. We went with him and we were driving. We'd driven to Denmark and back. And on our way back, we went to see the hip-hop dentist. Yeah. And he said, "Oh, I've got pain from my wisdom teeth." And the dentist goes, "Jump in the chair, let's have a look." You know, and bear in mind, if you have wisdom teeth in England, it's like some big drama and you've got to pay loads of money and all this different shit. So anyway, the guy looks, Dr. David, looked in his mouth and goes, "Yeah, don't worry about that." Give him an injection and whipped his wisdom teeth out there and then when we were just in the room. And he goes, "There you go." And it was just a really unusual thing to happen. You know, we were just passing and he goes, "Yeah, I'll take wisdom teeth out. Just and put them in a jar." And then he goes, "How much money do you want?" He goes, "No, I don't give me nothing." It was a laugh, wasn't it? it was crazy. It was really funny.
So, okay, apart from the obvious that, you know, it's almost attributed to Norm's passing, that you represent.
I mean, that's why they've got Norm written on the bottom ones, because he was the connection to get them done. And then, you know, I've got Arrow written across the top. And it's like, I know the way I look at it is like, you can't do it subtle. There's no point having gold teeth if you're trying to be subtle. I'm not, and I've never tried to be subtle. And the other thing is I want it because I totally believe in Brand Arrow. You know, if I go to an art gallery or I go somewhere or I'm doing something,
you want to own it.
I have to own it. And if I want other people to buy my paintings or to buy into the concept of what I do, I have to make myself memorable. You know, and it's like I'm so. You know, a posh person who's got loads of money, who's interested in what I'm doing, you know, they might go to an art gallery and go, "Oh my God, I met him. He's so unusual. You know, he's got all gold teeth and covered in tattoos. I don't know, you know," and they'll go away and they won't forget. They might have talked to 10 artists that night, but they'll never forget that they spoke to me because, you know, it's just that, isn't it?
Are you taking notes, people? Like, when you're talking about branding and stuff like that, the handshake is everything.
But when I don't think I'm the oracle of it. I'm just saying that's worked for me, you know. Yeah. It's like, I've never really been able to hide, and I never have hidden, you know, from the early day of graphitism with my face on the front. It's like, well, what's the point?
Yeah, you've never had any shits given. I mean, obviously, there's no pixelation here.
No.
You've never cared, have you?
No.
Never even given it a second fuck.
I just think it's because, you know what I mean? It's like, what's the fucking point? They've got to catch me. Or, you know, what am I doing wrong? I'm not actually doing anything wrong anymore. In England.
Not here.
No, but I don't really do that much wrong anymore. I'm a reformed character.
Oh, yeah? How do you figure that?
Well, I don't know. I haven't done anything... I'm trying to think. I haven't done anything wrong this year.
Okay.
New Year's resolution.
And all that.
Yeah.
You coming on, though? The pieces. And I'm not just... That sounds almost like...
I mean, I like being honest. I'll be absolutely honest. My new pieces are nowhere near as good as my old pieces, and I'll be the first to admit that. I know that. And I'm in a bit of a creative dip, and I know that. And I think part of being honest with yourself is part of being able to identify your pitfalls and work on them. So I know that I need to bring my graffiti back to the levels it was at, like 5 years ago. I felt powerful, and right now I'm going through the motions. And I think by saying it, a lot of people were already thinking that anyway, and they know that. But I think admitting it is a strength rather than a weakness.
Certainly not thinking that.
I am. If you're being completely honest, I don't think my new pieces are anywhere near as good as my old ones.
But the new,
and that's not a fish. I'm not fishing for shit.
No, that's just the way you feel.
Yeah, I mean, I've had to split my focus so much. You know, it's like with this whole thing with the art gallery stuff. It's like once you start flirting with that, and people can say, "Oh, you know, it's a sellout." Yeah, it is kind of a sellout. But then also doing graffiti for your whole job, it's really hardcore, because what you've actually got to do is, you know, when my kids need dinner, I've got to pay for that with graffiti. Mm-hmm. When I've got to pay my mortgage, I've got to pay for that with graffiti. When I have a bill for my car or to buy my car, I had to pay for that with graffiti. Mm. So in effect, it could be deemed as a sellout, but technically it's a full commitment to graffiti. So it's almost the opposite. You know, I was already immersed fully in graph, but then I've had to commit to the fact that I've got to eat from it.
Mm.
So it's a natural progression to try to sell my paintings in the gallery. And what I've had to come to understand is the language that we speak in graffiti. And when I say language, I'm talking about the way we portray our names, the different things we use to create, you know, what we're doing. You've got to change all of them. It's almost like translating or learning a new language. And I don't want that to sound poncy and nonsense, but when you get involved in the art gallery, you've got to recognise that people aren't going to buy, you know, a piece of graffiti. They need to, you can sell them.
They need to buy into it.
You can sell them elements of graffiti, but you can't sell them a letter. You know, you might paint the dopest letter A, and they'll just go, yeah, cool, whatever. They don't care.
Other
graffiti writers might go, oh my God, that's the sickest A I've ever seen. But other graffiti writers won't buy it.
It's true.
So this is the problem. So you have to try to adapt what you're doing. So a lot of my canvas that I've done has taken a lot of my attention away from doing graffiti. But then I can't complain, because I've been fairly successful in doing that, you know, so I can't be angry with it.
It's very interesting.
I've just had to split my targets, you know, so it's like graffiti has had to take a back seat for the time being, but hopefully that'll be because then I make enough money from all the canvases to continue the lifestyle which I've become accustomed to, which feels like not even ever having a job. I don't even remember having a job the last job I had.
Which is the best feeling
in the world. It's amazing. Yeah. But I can't complain about it. But, you know, I've done all different stuff. You know, I've worked with Graffiti Kings. I've worked with Global Street Art. I've worked with all the different big agencies in the country. You know, and people ring me up and say, oh, can you come paint my gym? I don't really want to, and I don't put it on Instagram, but I do it because it's, to me, it's like, yeah, cool, I'll do it. You want to pay me that money, I'll do it. You know, are we ranting? Is this sense?
No, I think, you know what? I think what's interesting, where you're coming from, actually, if we circle it back to where people begin in graph in the first place, you know, the hardcore aesthetic, like we are this, we are that, we represent that. Not in 1 minute do you forecast, graffiti particularly I'm talking about here, that it's going to become something of an exhibited thing that you end up being, and then you have to be responsible with this thing and take it there.
Then the interesting thing about that is, like, you know, if people look at their what they consider like the Bible or the style guide for graffiti, which would be like Subway Art or Style Wars or any of these things. Even in Star Wars, which was made in what, 1982, people, they're already talking about this issue in 1982. That's 40 years ago. So it's not a new issue
because they're talking
about the graffiti guys that are selling their art in the canvas in the graffiti gallery, in the art gallery, sorry. Yeah. So you've then got Scheme's opinion to it, then you've got the other artists. So it's always been in graffiti. Mm. And I understand both sides. You know, when I first started doing graffiti, if someone had said, oh, you're going to put it in art gallery, I would never have admitted that to my friends. I'd have just gone, nah, man, I just want to write my name on everything. I just want to do trains. Yeah. I just want to do this. And that was all I've thought about. But what I've actually come to realise is, when we do graffiti, we're effectively advertising a brand that has no products.
That's true.
Which is really an unusual thing. No other brand goes so out of its way to risk so much to advertise effectively nothing. Which is mental.
And for that reason, we love it even more.
Because
is a complete contradiction to
everything. It's the ultimate Trivial Pursuit, isn't it, graffiti? Yeah. It's a madness. But I love it.
It is funny. And this might segue nicely because obviously you weren't just a graffiti writer for many years, early days and before. You were very much in with all the graph and hip-hop elements, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, when we were really young, I mean, we were all into breakdancing. When we were little kids, it was like, because obviously I'm one of the older generation of British people that were into graph. You know, I remember when we had BMXs, we all used to we'd all go and do dirt jumps and shit. And then when we'd stop jumping or whatever, we'd all go, oh my God, I'm going to do that robot shit that I saw. You know what I mean? And you'd all try and do robotics and shit. And we were all really into it because we lived in this area that had this really strange influence because it had this guy that would do robotics as busking in the town from as early as 1980.
Wow.
So he was it was really unusual. So all the kids at the school knew what robotics were. So when I know it's got other names, but when breakdancing effectively blew up, it was already like, oh, well, we were already doing robots, and then we just do that. So I remember when we all first saw Buffalo Girls, it kind of tied a load of things together. Well, I'm not saying that we were advanced, but we were.
It answered all those questions.
Yeah, and we were kind of aware of something was happening. And you know what I mean? Like, a lot of people I mentioned this in that. That taxi cabs interview things that I did with All City Steve, I touched on it in there, and I'll touch on it briefly now for anyone who hasn't seen that one. It's like a lot of people talk about those days, and they'll make out they had this mythological prowls at this and that. We were shit at breakdancing, and we were shit at body popping. There was kids around us that were amazing, but that didn't in any way inhibit our enjoyment of it. You know what I mean? When it was your turn to go in the circle, you'd go in and you'd do your shit down rock. You know, but you didn't care because it was that feeling that nothing else gave you that feeling other than that, you know? So it was a really beautiful time.
Nice.
But I can't pretend, you know, we weren't dancing to Two Copies of Apache and we weren't dancing to, you know, all these famous breakbeats. We weren't doing that. We were breakdancing to whatever the youth club would play pop music wise and any record that was on the electro albums.
Yeah, you
that
just
was it.
You kind know, of figuring it out as spoon fed to
so
you.
So it was a really good time, but I can't suddenly assign any importance to it other than an emotional one of how it made me feel. Like, I can't suddenly say this built a building block for this, because it didn't. It just was something that was a really beautiful thing that we all enjoyed as a group of lads when we were little kids, you know, me and my little brother. And then there was the Baldwin brothers that were incredible at breaking. And then there was Lee Rose, you know, Mr. Toes, who went on to being Born to Rock. And there was another guy, Jay Adams. And then there was another guy called Gavin Clark, who was he's probably about 5 or 6 years older than us. He was incredible. And you're just like, where are these people coming from? You know, it's like, so we
all
had this really
got these
weird,
skills.
Yeah, and we had this weird town. Where it had, you know, you'd go
where
and have
this?
A...
Whereabouts was this?
This is in like Hive and Folkestone, you know, weirdest places of all time. And you'd go and have like breakdancing battles. But it was just a strange time, you know. But this sort of set a lot of us on our way. And then breakdancing went out of fashion. And a lot of people don't even talk about this part, but being of my age, I remember coming back to school after the summer holidays, we're still all into breaking and graffiti and hip-hop, or not hip-hop, rap, or whatever the music was called at that time, electro. And everyone else is like, Oh, you're still into that shit. That's dry.
Oh, you know what no, I mean? Literally, it was like night and day.
Honestly, it was like light had been switched
off. That's harsh.
And there was about, I think there was like me, Danny Newland, Manuel Rendo, and Darren Southern, and my brother. Mm. And we were basically the only kids that were left that were into that. We were just like, oh my God. In a school of 1,500 kids. So it was, that was a dry, that's dry so spell, that cold. Was. And then we had to move more into Graff. You know, but then that took us on another thing. And then we met up with this guy called Surprise, one of the coolest old school names I've ever heard.
Very much.
Surprise. And DJ Clear, and Clear, who was Paul Godfrey, who went on to be more Chiba.
Yes,
and then again, our whole thing then took a natural turn where we went from doing tagging to doing tagging but hanging around with these guys that wanted to do music. So we were like, what do you mean? And they're like, well, let's try to make the music we're listening to. And I was like, how'd you do that?
Yeah, that's so a lot at
this
any
kid,
age.
These kids that were like a year younger than me were going, yeah, we can do it like this. So we would start to try to go around and they're saying, yeah, this is made out of this drum break and this is this. And we were like, that's mental. Yeah, yeah. So then we started trying to search for drum breaks in the late 80s. And then we had a guitar delay and we put the music into the guitar delay and put it in a four track.
How did you figure that out?
Well, Paul Godfrey, the guy who went on to be more Chiba, he was like a bedroom genius, basically. Honestly, the shit he used to do, like we'd put in a loop that would be about 140 beats per minute, and we'd be like, "Well, you can't rap on that. No one can do anything with that. You can't even scratch that." So then, what they would do is he'd then put the four track up to full speed, record in 5 minutes at full speed. Yeah, then, we had no idea what tempo anything was we were making. We just turn the speed down till it sounded right, and then anything we put on top would have to be done live from the turntables over the top and then recorded in on the four track.
Really?
So everything was like a live recording.
That's so sharp.
So again, very it was cool. A lot of fun, and all of us all learnt how to do keeping two copies of a record going, because it's like, you know, we come home from work or school or whatever and we had one set of decks that all of us used to use, and I've still got one of them turntables, is still in my house, and we'd do all these different things, and it was just real. It was like a, you know, we're making our own entertainment. Mm-hmm. So then this is how this sort of weird thing for making bits of music and doing stuff. And then we were getting bored with going to Folkestone, so we decided to go to Ashford.
Which is also in Kent.
Another town in Kent. Yeah. But again, it was one of those things, you know, when you were younger, you didn't really go to that town if you lived in this town. You know, it was a different area. Yeah, yeah. It's a bit different now, I think. So we all went there and we met up with all these kids in the street that were all dressed like we were dressed like into hip hop, and they were saying, yeah, there's a hip hop disco every Sunday night at the Top Rank Bingo Hall. And we were like, what? So this was like on a Saturday. So we go, we'll come tomorrow. And they're like, yeah, come tomorrow.
Isn't it weird? It's like, you've got 10 miles up the road and the whole
attitude.
They had
a whole completely different thing going on. So we were like, this is cool. So this is probably like 86 or something like that. So we then go, or 87 maybe. So we then go to this thing, and it's this bloke called Disco Gary who was doing these hip-hop jams every Sunday night. But I say hip-hop. They'd play a load of rap, then they'd play sort of things like pop house music, you know, like Marshall Jefferson and Steve Silk Hurley and all this sort of shit, and then like sort of weird poppy soul music. So, but it was cool because you wouldn't get to hear rap music in Kent. Yeah, you know, in the 80s.
It's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, so it was a bit of a mind melter. Yeah. So we'd all go to that, and then...
So you were... Well, how old were you then? At this point?
Probably 16, maybe 17. It's probably 17. Age, right? Yeah. So it was a big thing, and then...
You're travelling at 16, 17, all across country. Well, across
Well, there was nothing Kent, to do in our own town. Yeah. Then he moved... Then we found out that he was doing these things. This is probably by the end of this, probably about 88. Mm. We found out he was doing these things in Orpington Civic Centre on a Friday. So by this time, we'd also met Cell One and Blob, a.k.a. First Rate, and we'd met these guys because they were from Paddock Wood. So they would come. So all this thing in Ashford would draw people from everywhere because it was the only place you could listen to rap loud.
Cell One, of course, is Gutter Snipes.
Yeah, Gutter Snipes. And he was part of the music group that we formed called First Down. So First Down was almost like a weird, it's almost like a collective. Even though it's got core members that never changed, it had a whole series of people that a lot of people have heard of.
That's what it felt like. That's what it felt like.
It was like a weird collective of people.
Couldn't quite pin down who it was exactly.
Yeah, that was sort of, that wasn't intentional. I just think that it was a really strange thing, because when it first started off, you've got the guy who then went on to be more Chiba, making learning all the beats. And then when he went off to be more Chiba, I learned everything I could from him. And then I became the guy that would make the beats. Mm. And then I would get Indian Rope Man, who was signed to Skint Records. Mm-hmm. He would help me with all the engineering. And then later on, a guy called Blues would help. He was really amazing. Still makes amazing music now. And this is sort of how it would work. And then, you know, through that, we got signed to Cold Sweat Records, and that on that project particularly, it was Cell One and First Rate had left by this point. And when we were recording, Prime Cuts was our DJ.
Yeah, this is the bit because this is, if you've not checked out the Prime Cuts podcast, we literally had a conversation after saying, "Hey, you missed that bit." I mean, explain that. I might not completely work so, in so accordance to what you're saying.
In the Kent area, what happened was that they'd become this real sort of nucleus of people that were obsessed with the how you made hip hop, you know. So there was loads of people that would collect break beats and cut doubles and people that would rhyme. But it was like a real culture of it, and it was really nice. You know, we didn't really think of it as special at the time, but it was just something we thought everybody did. Mm. So you'd have like the whole Gravesend crew, they were ridiculously good. So you had people like Prime Cuts and MC Chess, which, you know, a lot of people forget all about these people, but in like 87, 88, these people were, he was important, you know,
because
he,
the water over them, you know, places, you know.
And then you had the other DJs from there, like a guy called Plastic Money, who ended up moving to Philadelphia apparently, and then he had an MC, but I can't remember what his name was. And then you had The Edge, you know, so all of these people that were all like really good, all from one place.
God,
and then
I love your throwing names out like that, because this is like history, right?
And then you had First Rate and Cell One from Paddock Wood, you know, which is a village near sort of halfway between Maidstone and Tunbridge. You know, it's like these really weird places. Mm. And we were from another village, technically Hive. And then, you know, we would connect with all these people, and it was a really, really interesting time, you know.
And were you still painting at that time?
No, well, what had happened was by 1989, I'd been given 6 months in prison, but it had been suspended for 2 years for, again, when we'd all go to the thing in Ashford, all of us would tag the trains relentlessly a week, because then what would happen is you'd go to, oh, right, hang on, I've missed one bit. They'd moved the thing from the Top Rank bingo hall down to this nightclub in Ashford called Dusty's, and that's when it really picked up traction. Mm. So then it'd become like a hub for every graffiti writer from the southeast. So there'd be all of the main writers at the time. So you had people like Stormer, Care, Nerve, Risk, and Mecca, and Amp, and Ask, and Carve, Coat, Strobe. All of these people from all around. And then you had people like from BKE, NRS, you know, so it was Bomb Crazy Elite, New Rexters, AVZ, Mafia. You know, Mafia from AVZ is Spencer's older brother, who I do Viva La Vanda with. You know, it's crazy circles go round and round, you know. So all of these people,
come on,
all of these people would gravitate to this place on Sunday, and then you'd compare the damage that was being done. You know, so it was a really interesting time. You know, and apologies if I missed people out, but I'm trying to think at 100 miles an hour, but I've missed hundreds of people out. Mm. But this kind of reached a fever point, and I was one of the people, unfortunately, that got caught. I got caught towards the end, but, you know, like nearly everybody got caught, you know, so.
Yeah, I guess it's part of the course, isn't it?
So I'd been caught for graffiti, so my interest, it was like split then between, do I want to carry on doing tagging? I've got 6 months hanging over me for 2 years. I've managed to slip out of this somehow. Mm. I don't really want to go to prison. I'm going to focus on this music with my friends because we're having a right laugh. Mm. So I'd still do tagging, but you know what I mean?
What was your demeanour as a kid? What was your kind of, were you a mild-mannered child when you was younger?
I was really little until I was about 18.
Really?
Like, I was like one of the really little kids at school. Yeah, and then it was almost like we all left school, and then I saw people after school, like, you know, when we'd come back, and I was like about a foot taller.
So
it was one of them things.
That's
a
mad one.
But we hung around with such a cool clique of people, you know. It was like there was a whole load of us, like, all through this period as well, like towards the end of sort of 89, 90, we'd all do things like, we'd go to the Slammer in Gravesend, or the Red Lion in Northfleet or the Grasshopper in Westerham.
Like local and places.
No, they weren't local to us. They were like an hour and a bit drive. You know, we'd have to get in our car. We'd you know, where we lived, you all learnt to drive when you were 17 because you lived in the countryside. You'd have no choice.
That's the same as me,
So you as soon as you were 17, you tried to pass your driving test as fast as possible, get a shit car, and then we'd all pile in these cars and drive places.
So true.
So, you know, I remember all these unusual things, and like, I remember the first time I ever heard a lot of records was, you know, we'd go to these things, and like, we'd end up in places like someone would say, oh, they're playing hip hop in Excalibur's in Gillingham. Now, Excalibur's in Gillingham is probably one of the worst nightclubs in the world. But every now and then there'd be a certain DJ that would play a mix of rap mixed in with what he was doing. Yeah. So you would go there because there was nowhere else to listen to
it. Just for these five or six songs.
Yeah. And then we'd go to things like the Kent Soul Festival in Margate.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And I remember, you know, but there was a whole gang of us that would do this. And, you know.
In the search for hip hop.
And so many interesting things happened. I remember one night we went to some mad place and I can't remember what it was, but it was some party somewhere between sort of Croydon, Tunbridge, but sort of north of Eastbourne, but somewhere in the middle, somewhere like
a Penge kind of.
Well, I don't know where it was. It was in Kent somewhere, but it was like some weird outdoor party and First Rate. And it was me, Clear, Surprise, First Rate, Cell, and then a bunch of their friends, you know, that were all from the Paddock Wood, Tunbridge area. We were all there. And First Rate had done a load of scratches. And then some guy goes, oh, can I have a go on turntables? And we were just like, yeah, bro, whatever. It's not our turntables. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. And this guy got on there and he was ridiculous. And none of us knew who he was. And then afterwards we were talking to him. He's going, oh, yeah, I'm obsessed with DJ Joe Cooley. And we were just like, bro, who's this person? We know who Joe Cooley was, but we didn't know who this guy was, you know. So we had all these really interesting things that were going on, you know.
So who was the DJ then? Do you know who he was?
No, still don't know. Oh. And then there was other things like...
I thought you were going to say it's like DJ Format or something.
No. But I mean, the Format comes into the story a bit later on, you know? And then, but when we would, like I say, we'd go to these Disco Gary things. I don't know anyone who's listening is thinking, fucking hell, this is a rambling load of nonsense. But
all right, kid, keep on going, kid.
We'd go to the Orpington Civic Centre. So then you get people like, you know, Dexter and people like that would go to that. So we'd meet people like him.
Which correlates with the Brotherhood episode. Yeah, so... check that podcast out.
And then... you know, it's all these unusual connections that we formed being from this weird place just outside Folkestone. And then every hip-hop concert that was in London, we'd go to it relentlessly. We'd go up there on the train, go to the concert, walk around London all night and then get the first train back home. We'd do that every single big concert there was. We'd do it.
I think people underestimate the... being
the
in a
countryside
city
bumpkin was a motivator.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like being a constant underdog. Yeah. You know, we would, like... I remember there was one particular time that was really funny. We kept having these jams. Like, eventually Disco Gary stopped doing his jams, so we had to put our own jams on. So we bought a sound system, but we didn't... I mean, we rented it first time, but we made so much money, we were able to buy the speakers and everything. We could never afford the amp, so we used to hire the amp. But we had turntables and these massive speakers. And we used to hire this hall out called the Old Labour Halls in Folkestone. And we used to do these jams called the Assembly Lines.
There you go.
And what we would do was we were quite mindful that if you just played straight rap non-stop...
people get...
girls don't go.
Yeah,
and you don't want a hall full of blokes. It's a bit boring. So what we would do is we would mix the breaks that we'd been finding because we were then into the breaks. We'd mix them with the rap records and then you get girls to come. So then you had sort of like these hip-hop jams that were like a third girls and two-thirds blokes, maybe a bit higher, maybe more girls. But they were great and they were really good parties.
So for people inside London, that just became the hot spot.
Yeah, so if you lived outside, you knew this party was going to go on. They were like, I think we used to charge like £2 or something stupid.
Easy.
And, you know, it would be ram out. And people would come just because it was mental.
So cool.
And... that was just really good fun. And, you know, that would be, you know, Cell One would be there, First Rate would be there, all different types of people. And then we did quite a few of those and then we moved them to this other place called La Gruta, which was this mad club underneath a Spanish restaurant in a hotel. And I remember by this point, all of us could cut doubles of everything. So if you went somewhere and someone was going, I want to rap, we'd be like, okay, cool. I'd get some records out. Even though I'm not a DJ, I could put the records on.
Just back to back it.
Yeah, just keep it going perfectly.
10 minutes
for
long.
Anyone who wanted to rap, I could keep it going. And then someone would go, oh, I want to go.
Training grounds.
But it was just funny. Yeah. It was a really funny time. And I think, you know, and I'm not saying that other people should do that. My thing about it was just, it was, that was what we did, and it was good. You know, I think there's a lot of problem now with guys of my age that somehow feel that youngsters coming into hip hop or rap need to be drilled and schooled in old stuff. And I just think,
couldn't agree more.
Like, let's put this in perspective, right? Yeah. In 1982, which was the year before it really blew up for us, but is considered to be a real pinnacle of hip hop, for example, that's 40 years ago. So in 1984, you're telling me I've got to be interested. You know, so you're telling now, sorry, you take some kid now from, let's pick an area, a kid from Camden who's interested in rap. He's 13, 14 years old. Right, you're interested in rap, right? Oh, right, you've got to listen to this from 84. You've got to do this. You've got to listen to this. Oh, this, done that. He's thinking, bro, this is dry. I'm not interested. This is rubbish.
You're already putting the brakes on it because they're telling me what to do.
Yeah, yeah. That is like getting me when I'm 14 and telling me I've got to do and be interested in shit they were doing in 1944.
Yeah, I'm with you, 100% with you on
1944. That. 1944.
Yeah.
Bro, I'd have gone, drop me out.
Drop me out.
It's like, true, I'm though, doing this. It's interesting.
I'm with you.
So the modern version of what the kids are into is what they're into. And youth culture is for the youth. It ain't for old men to dictate to young men how they're doing it.
All.
And that's it. And I think it's very important for people not to, you know, the nostalgia thing is, I think a lot of these people wandering around look like they're them weird teddy boy people that were in the 80s when you look back and they thought they were Elvis.
Nostalgia is really comfortable when the world is going crazy. If the world is going mad, nostalgia is a really easy place to go, but you've got to fight through it.
I don't know.
Do you know what I mean?
I just think looking forward is almost much better. It's much more positive. You've got to look to the future because that's where you're going to live.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You don't live in the past.
And the rest of your families, your kids, they've all got to face that way forward as well.
Yeah.
If you're not facing it with them, then you're teaching them.
You try and take a kid now and telling him he's got to spend, what are Technics now, 500 quid each, are they? Mm-hmm. He's got to go and buy £1,000 worth of Technics, a mixer, and all this different shit, and then he's got to find a load of records, which he's got to buy hundreds of, and he's got to buy two copies of them, and he's got to keep it going so his friend can wrap it, go, no, it's all right, mate, I'll just loop that up on my phone.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, on my phone, yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. What do you mean, this whole one thing that happens on my phone? Yeah, we do that most Friday nights.
I'm sure you could download an MPC app on your phone. I bet there's one.
Oh,
I bet you can tap a beat on your phone.
Comment below. Actually, while we're on the subject of this, because obviously First Down happened and beats were being made, created, you've been quite proficient on Facebook Live, or were up until recently.
Yeah, are you talking about radio?
Yeah, but more importantly, I'm talking about your obsession and passion for obscure breaks.
Yeah, I have always had that. I think that came from the fact that when we were younger, our access to secondhand records, which was all we had, was a really odd selection. You know, so it's like, I remember when one of us found a Meters album, you know, it was like the holy grail of the world had opened, you know. So I think it was DJ Clear had found a Meters album, and we were just like, where did you find that? You know? We were just like melting, you know, whereas we were listening to things like, I've got a break off a Black Sabbath record. It's a good break, but, you know, it is just the rest of it's unlistenable.
Move on. Yeah.
And then it's like, you know, no disrespect to anybody who really enjoys Black Sabbath, but I think you get what I'm going for. It's like,
It's not breaks, and it's not the kind of thing you expect.
It was a bit like, you know, I had like five different Steve Miller Band albums because I lived, and I had some Jimi Hendrix albums that sounded like they might have had breaks on them. But, you know, our break collection was very white music, you know, from a white town by the sea. So it wasn't until we became older and we started to be able to sort of hunt and find shops where things were more what we were looking for or wanted.
Such an interesting way of putting it.
So we had to try to take little bits and snatches of things to make something good. But then in that, we were then always looking in the weirdest places. You know, I wouldn't necessarily always be looking for your stereotypical funk album with breaks on it, you know, which would have a group of assorted black dudes with afros. You know, that would... because we couldn't ever find records like that. So it wasn't really what we gravitated towards, because there just wasn't those. So then we started finding much more abstract records and getting breaks and things from that.
Well, yeah, because you're going into, like, Eastern Europe now. Yeah, like, I listened to some of your breaks, and you're like, oh, here's a, here's a covers band of a Belgium crew, the Belgian band doing a cover of something from the 1960s, slap that on, is this?
Yeah.
That's mad.
I mean, now that everything's changed. I mean, the maddest one was we went to a party in Guildford in 1990, and it was some hip-hop party. Again, you know, again, what were kids from Folkestone doing going to a hip-hop party in Guildford? Yeah. I mean, kids now wouldn't do that. You know, we had to bunk the train there, and then we went to this party, and the people were playing rap records, but they didn't really have very good rap records, because, you know, we'd all been going to Groove and going to Soho and buying all sort of unusual and rare and import rap by this point. You know, we were sort of connoisseurs of what we were buying. And so when we'd go to a hip-hop party by this point, we were those snobbish pricks, basically. And we were at this party, and these guys had sort of really basic records. But when they were playing
What
them,
have you got there? How dare you?
I know, UK pressing.
What? But,
and I frown upon myself for that. I should have just been enjoying myself.
Yeah, grab a bottle and enjoy yourself.
But we were at this party, and the benefit of it was there was a guy sitting opposite us who, all intents and purposes, looked like a mod. But he was the funniest guy at the party, and we were chatting to him, and a record had come on, and we go, oh, yeah, I quite like this one. And he go, oh, they've sampled so-and-so and so-and-so. And we were like, bro, you seem to know the break to everything. And he's going, oh, yeah, I collect records. So he's going, this party's shit, let's go. So me and the guy from Orchiba go off with this guy who we didn't know in Guildford, go around his house. He had one of the most outrageous breakbeat collections I'd ever seen. And he's about 5 or 6 years older than me. And he was, like, totally into sharing, going, oh, yeah, this is this. Do you know this? Doing this. And we spent the whole evening having our brains completely melted.
That is so
and I'm still friends with this guy to this day. Yeah, he ended up being one of my flatmate of mine for a while. You know, Format knows him. All of the people that are dear to me know this person. And if you want to be terrified...
He still collects.
Yeah, he's one of them people.
Is he still in Guildford?
No, he lives in Hastings now. And the beauty of it is I DJed with him about five years ago. Yeah. And we did a music sharing evening where it was the strangest evening. What they did was they arranged this bar place so that it had all tables and chairs and then it had a dance floor, but the DJs were on the floor with, like, couches around us. And then the idea was you have a microphone, and it was this bloke's idea whether it would work or not. And I personally think it was brilliant. So what had happened is you have to take the microphone and you say, you know, my name's so-and-so, and for the next hour and a half I'm going to be playing you Russian, Polish and Eastern Bloc funk and jazz.
Okay.
So then everyone who's come along has got to come along being open-minded, knowing that they're going to have a music discussion evening. So then what happens is you then take the record, put the cover in front of the turntables, play the record, and then all the people that are there can go, you know, it's a bit twiddly and jazzy, but, you know, they're going, oh, this is interesting. And then you invite people to come and talk to you. So then people come up and go, this ain't this can't be this, blah, blah, blah. You know, so you have this really
so
interesting
techers.
Conversation, but it was really so cool. And then they'd go back and talk to the people at their table. So it wasn't about being elitist about anything. It was just simply about sharing this mental music that normally you'd have to have someone in your house to play it to them. But it was done in a really cool way. And they'd put, obviously, people into the audience that they knew would ask questions. And then, you know, someone would say, oh, can you say... Like, so you say, for example, everyone's sitting there, they're obviously quite into music, and you play a Polish version of Use Me, the Bill Withers song, but covered by Peter Feagle. Play that. Of course, everyone's tapping their finger and thinking, this is fucking Use Me by Bill Withers.
Yeah, totally.
You know, but then they're thinking, well, what the fuck version is this?
That's right.
You know, so you go through and then you play, like, the Russian version of I Can't Stop by the John Davis Monster Orchestra that's got the break in it, but it does it twice.
But that's what I had in your, when I listened to your, because I was always listening, I was always jumping on whenever I knew it was on, I was in. You'd be like, yo, this is the da-da-da version of da-da-da. But it didn't process until you'd hear a certain chord change or a trill of a riff of somewhere that kind of reminds. It could just as well be a whole different tune.
Yeah, I'm mad. I think it's really interesting. I mean, this is a whole other podcast technically. But the way I just feel about it is I'm really passionate about hearing unusual music in the same way I'm passionate about looking at unusual art and different things in graffiti, you know? So, because it's so close to me, I love to share it with people and say, what do you think of this? You know, what's this? What do you think of that? You know, and I think it's a really important thing to share it, because the more people share unusual music, it limits the space in the world for shit music.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, if I'm doing a radio show and I'm playing like one of the last radio shows I did a cover version show where it had to be a cover version of a record that 90% of the population would know the song. Well, maybe not 90, but, you know, it wasn't a super rare record. Like, this is a super rare record covered by someone else with another super, you know, it's like, who knows what the original is. But, you know, I was playing things that people knew, playing them and then trying to do it so they all had a drum break in it, just to be stupid. You know, but it made it fun. And, you know, and in the end, I just got to the point where I was like, maybe I'll do it again, but I'm kind of done with it.
Just going back to what you said there about, I don't know, the giving arrow.
Sharing is very important.
Because, I mean, you passed me on sketches. You've always been offering your advice. You've shown up to things and you've done things. And
careful. I only offer advice when it's asked for. Never unsolicited
but
advice.
But the point I'm making is, though, it's very true, because that is absolutely correct. But what I find endearing the most is that it's this kind of selfless, yeah, I'll tell you, or I'll show you.
Yeah, well, I don't care. Like, as far as I'm concerned, it's like, say, for example, I was fortunate, like when we, like I said, we used to go to Groove Records and these different things. When the hip-hop went into the 90s and then all of a sudden you couldn't... It was corny to use Funky Drummer, or it was corny to use any of the major breaks off the Ultimate Breakbeat albums. You know, you didn't want to use James Brown samples, and everything went a bit Cypress Hilly and moody jazz, and everything slowed down. Mm. All of the records that I loved previously then went from the racks into the boxes at the bottom. So they then became the, like, £2 or £3 records. Mm. So when everyone was going there and buying the new record by this person or that person, which I probably was still guilty of buying, I would always go in the boxes in the bottoms of these shops and buy out, you know, records on stupid labels that just looked like someone had made them at home.
But how do you, but for a lot of the untrained here, including me, how do you know by...
Well, you don't. It's Russian roulette, isn't it?
So you're literally just buying around.
I'd buy like I'd go to the shop and buy like 2 or 3 new releases, and then I'd go in the boxes down the bottom and there'd be a load of things like, you know, any record that looks like it's hand-drawn with a pyramid on it. You're like, yeah, it's got to be good. You know, how mental is this rapper's name? I'll give it a go. You know, and you'd collect up sort of 5 or 6 of them, and what, you'd hand them, you'd see the people going, what the fuck do you want that shit for?
That's really interesting exercise, because I think the public's perception of a lot of these things, especially when it comes to...
That was Russian roulette, mate.
Yeah, it's all about how the name of the thing, what it looks like. Yeah. It still applies even now. It's just people don't... they're so used to it.
Yeah.
Isn't it funny?
Yeah. I know, we keep segueing away, don't we? We don't finish anything.
Carry on.
We were talking about Richie from Guildford.
Yeah, go on.
Right,
yeah,
sorry. So then he moves to Brighton. Right. Oh, and the other bit of the story, we were talking about the record sharing.
Yes.
The two sections that we've skipped away from.
Rewind!
So, the record sharing night with Richie. I've known him, at this point?
Best
20 part. Years?
Yeah.
More? Dude goes on the microphone, I'm going to play an hour and a half of psychedelic soul. I can't wait. I would consider myself quite versed in most things like that. Cool. Hour and a half, not one record I've ever heard.
Really?
Yeah, known him for 20 years. I was like, Rich, what the fuck's this? What's that? What's that? Oh, I've had this for years. Yeah, I've had that. Lived with him. All these records were in the flat that we rented.
And you
never heard of them.
Always keep close to the people that give you the new music, that tell you
Bro,
about new
the
music.
Bloke's just distributes nuggets, mate.
Mad.
He's got heaters for
20 years.
Like when we did the First Down album, for example, he lent me samples on there that have only just recently come to light of what they were, you know.
Mad.
So it's like we sampled records years ago that now are records that are worth, you know, just shy of £100. If you try and buy them on Discogs, we were sampling them in 93.
Man,
which
is
mental.
World, this
it's just funny,
world.
I think, you know, because again, I'm not, none of it's done from a sort of, all of it's done from a kind place. You know, I only share it and talk about it with enthusiasm. None of it's one-upmanship. It's all just about, you know, I want the infectiousness of enthusiasm to shine through.
Yeah,
that's all it is. It's enthusiasm.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
but can I say as well, is you stamp authority on things. You're a good gauge of a good thing, and you'll back it. Not a lot of people have.
Well,
that
if something's good, it's good.
It. Yeah, yeah.
That's the end of it. Even if it's someone I don't like, if they do that something's good, I'll just say, yeah, I don't like that person. They're a prick, but that is sick. Because you,
what's the most recent example of that, may I ask?
Listen, I might admit it's good, but I ain't promoting it.
Good work there. Good work there, Harrow.
Right, well, while we're being smart, let's get back to the story. Yes. So anyway, Richie's my flatmate. We go to a charity shop in Brighton one day. This was back before charity shops had Discog advisors.
Yeah, okay.
And this is probably like 95, early 95. And there's a massive stack of Eastern Bloc records in this charity shop. They're like 10p each. So we select like a handful, like a few, bring them back to the flat. And we're just thinking, Christ. Oh, really? This is going to be hit or miss, isn't it? I wonder if this 50p has been well spent.
It's what they call job lot.
So anyway, first record that comes out is some album from the Czech Republic by a group called Fermata. Put that on, put it on.
Bang.
Boom, drums just come pouring through the speaker. We're like,
hello.
What is this? So we go through and there's about four breaks on this album. We're like, this is ridiculous. Next record that goes on is a record called Petrojanu's Pro Rock Explodes. And it's like a 1980s Suzy Quattro album from Czech Republic.
What? Right.
But it's not, it's more glitter with like fuzzy permed hair.
Yeah, yeah, no.
Put it on, one of the most evil drum breaks I've ever heard comes out of this record. And we're like, bro, we've got a taxi straight back to the charity shop.
Went, them.
Went to the woman, right, we'll have all them. She's like, what? Yeah, we'll take all of them. I think it came to something like 16 quid or something.
Laughing at
like,
the
and
door.
We had armfuls of them, like piling these absolute mental records into this taxi. Go back to the apartment, to the flat. You see me being, speak to Europeans, saying apartment. Apologies. So we go back, make cups of tea, and we're sitting in the lounge with the turntables, going through everything. Miss, hit. You know what I mean? And we end up with a stack of rubbish like that that's all like country and Western, Dixie and all this mad shit. But we end up with a stack like this of absolute face melters. Wow. You know, like some of the stuff you just
stuff
like,
you still
to
now.
This day, if people come to my house, I can pull it out and say, this is like in the first batch of records I ever found from the Eastern Bloc.
Wow.
I don't know where they came from, how they were there or anything, but all I know is it was just mega good luck.
But that's what, we're just going back to, this is the importance of it. It's like it's in the journey. The story you're telling... You can't make that up. That's what happens with music.
Credit where credit's due, though. This was 95. However, we weren't the first because anyone who knows MC Storm, who was from the No Parking MCs, produced by Cutmaster Swift, Playing the Field, really famous, sought-after British rap record, which, you know what I mean, I'm also a big fan of because of the Crown Jewels. Playing the Field uses a sample of a Russian group called Arsenal. Wow. What were they doing finding that and using that back in the day? So people always wondering what that thing is. That's Arsenal from Russia. Mental. So I love that. And that, look, I've got goosebumps. That's so cool that they used that back then. I always had total respect for that. Because as soon as we found that Arsenal record, we're like, bro, that's like MC Storm Playing the Field.
That's a game in itself. That's exactly what it should be about.
Yeah. And so straight after we found them records, I said to my then girlfriend, oh, I want to go on a romantic trip to Prague, just me and you. Yeah. We're going, it'll be amazing. She's like, oh, that's so sweet. Yeah. So we go there, we're doing all this shit, and I'm constantly looking, find a record shop, go there. Spend all of our money for the trip.
Yeah. Five hours later.
No, I didn't. You couldn't even. I just was like, that looks good. That looks good. That looks good. Wrapped them up in string, and she's just looking at me going, you prick.
Yeah. Keep done.
So then we come home on the plane, and honestly, it was like I was cutting my fingers off on the string, just trying to carry these blocks of vinyl whack on string. And I bought them back, and. You know, again, it was loads of hit and misses. Like half of what I bought back was just went straight into the charity shop. But the rest of it, again, I've still got to this day.
Do people get it? Like girlfriends are a good example. And that, to be fair, is on balance. But people, the obsession of hip hop and the way it's curated and how we digest and take it all in and are a part of it. It's quite it's all consuming. It's quite a lot for people to take in, isn't it?
But I mean, I think it's all down to how you manage it as yourself, don't you? It's like I'm a nerd, and I know I am, and I know that I care too much about things that are fundamentally not very important, but to me they're important. But what I try to do is I try to keep a really stiff lid on it so that I don't come off like
it's got the cool lid.
Well, is it, I mean, I'm letting the lid off here, aren't I? It's like people watching this thinking, oh, only 40 did graph. It's like, yeah, I do, really. Now we're talking about, you know.
I think the lack of connectivity between genres within street culture is like, you've got to bring them together. It's super important.
But does it matter? Does anything matter? This is the whole thing, isn't it? Does anything really matter? I think all that matters is the pleasure you derive from whatever you're doing. It's like, you know, I've got my little nucleus of friends that enjoy the same type of records that I try to collect. It's like, I should make a WhatsApp group, but I've effectively got a group of friends that's got like Punk from Heavy Artillery, Opium from Heavy Artillery, a guy from Germany called Paul, and a few other different people that whenever I buy a whole bunch of mad records, and my friend Steve from Sandgate, Steve Flash Collins, I drive him mental. I'm like,
come on below, Steve.
Pick up yourself. Get ready for some more incoming madness. So I'll buy like a bunch of records or they'll arrive, and then I'll just video them and then just go, have that. And there's like 10 little mini videos of all the new things I've found. And they'll just go, yeah, thanks, mate. I'm at work. Cool. Bye. You know, and then it'd be, but other times they'll go, oh, that's amazing. What's this? What's that? And then when they find records, they video them and send them to me.
I like it when you play the stories. I guess that's where these videos come from.
Yeah, I mean, it's to do with those, you know. And again, my Instagram stories, a lot of the time, it's like, if someone messages me, as long as they're polite, I'll tell them what the record is. You know, a lot of the time I've had people message me, go, break, with a question mark. It's like they're saying, what is it?
Brazen.
And I just think, bro, not even a please or thanks. Yeah. You know, it's a bit dry.
That is a bit dry. Who does that?
A lot of people, you'd be surprised. But if someone messages me and goes, oh my God, this piece of music's incredible. What is it? And I'll go, oh, it's this. Here's a photograph of the label, everything. I don't care. If you find it and you want to listen to it, bro, fill your boots.
Yeah.
Because I think this is the other thing. When you collect things, anybody that collects, this is a really, really important thing people need to do when they look at themselves, right? Why are you collecting?
Mm.
Are you collecting to show off, or are you collecting out of enjoyment? And is your enjoyment derived from showing off?
That's right.
Very important.
Hugely important.
Very, because what happens is if that is the case, it starts to become coveting, which is owning something simply so others can't. And that is a really evil trait.
Yeah, it's not attractive.
So it's very important that if you really love music, you say, look, bro, you know, it's like anyone I know, if they're, you know, who's a producer or they want to make a music or they want to do this, if they see a break that I've put on one of them things and they're like, bro, what's that? I've got to sample that. I'm like, cool, here it is. There you go. Use it. I'm not going to do anything with it. You know, it's like, I've produced quite a few records, you know, which is one of my little side hobbies, you know, so I don't, again,
bad
promote
boy beats,
that.
Man. Bad boy beats.
But it's, again, it's just done for fun. So if I've got some mega sample and someone goes, oh, I want to use that, I'm like, bro, do it.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I think it's important.
Again, it's that act of giving.
Or just not coveting. You know, what are you collecting it for? You know, I found myself doing it. Like, at some point, like, you know, when this thing, I don't know, was it 10 or 12 years ago, this random rap thing blew out of control. You know, that type of super rare late 80s, early 90s, independently released rap records.
Yes,
called random rap.
Yeah.
I accidentally had loads of that because of this going to Groove Records and buying all the shit records that were out of fashion, out of the bottom of the boxes, and always buying that type of rap when I was out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there were certain records that had gone astronomically high in price that I had, you know. And then a lot of the time I'd then start thinking, oh, I've got a pretty strong collection of that. I'm going to buy that. And then in the end I'd be buying records just so I could show off about them. And I'm thinking, bro, what are you doing? You spent 400 quid on
money.
A 12-inch
just
so that you can show off to like three people that
and
you've got it.
You've
and
got,
I thought, bro, what have you done?
Yeah.
So what I did was I actually went through, like, for example, there's an album called Back to the Lab, which is like a super rare North Carolina album, and it's all to do with the Busy Boys and the Rhythm Fanatic and all them lot, Will Ski and all them lot. Obviously, Will Ski went on to be in Original Flavor and now Ski Beats, making all the stuff for Jay-Z.
Here's some history for you.
He was the rapper. So there's this whole compilation album of all of their friends of the Busy Boys. I had that album sealed. Why? Why? Why have you got that album sealed? You're a prick. So
there's
I sold it.
There's no point, is there?
No, what's the point? What's the point in having an album worth that much money?
Clever me, I've got it wrapped and sealed. No one else has got it.
Well done.
Yeah, it's silly. You know, I know.
There's a feather for your hat. Cool. Yeah. You look like a knob wearing it.
And it's the same. I've always been like that. I like wearing boots. I don't leave them in cupboards. I don't leave them in shoe boxes. You put your sneakers on, you wear them. I'm all for that.
And, you know, again, this isn't me being negative to anybody who does that. I'm just saying, for me personally, I've asked myself those difficult questions, and I think people that collect heavily need to ask themselves some questions.
But that doesn't equal Josh Cole or Kish Kash, because these
Josh Cole sold all his trainers.
Has he sold them
all?
Yeah,
they're gone, man.
But these guys,
he's gone all Tai Chi, isn't he?
Has he really?
Bro's like walking on rice paper and shit.
Oh, tight, Josh. That's my guy.
Yes,
and big up Kish Kash as well.
And he shot the cover of the Crown Jewels.
He said to me that he did photo shoots the only time that Dilated Peoples came over to the country altogether.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, first of all, I didn't see that coming. I didn't see them even in the country. Yeah. Any photos. You know.
Funny you should say that, I have.
So big up that man, honestly.
Yeah. I've got a lot of time for Josh.
Yes, me too. What's Brighton saying at the moment?
In terms of what?
In terms of
graffiti?
Yeah.
Nothing.
Really?
It's dry.
Dry? How dry?
It's just, I don't know, there's people that are doing stuff. I can't knock them, you know, in respect to them, because they're continuing. I just think that the glory days of Brighton Graff.
The moon.
Everything's, the real glory was like 5 or 6 years ago, when it was everyone doing pieces all through the centre of Brighton. That was the best.
And if you don't know about that story, then you're missing out on the
It was just a mental time. But, you know, it was the public were forced just to eat it. And that was how it was working. And then, you know, I think it was a victim of its own success, because then what you get is you get every kid who wants to go to university who acts like bad man graph writer. They're from some village up north, and they're going, oh, if I do my university course at Brighton, I'll be able to be part of that Brighton graffiti scene. So they turn up for a year, get pissed off because they haven't got the actual bottle to do the proper pieces. So what they do is just do throw-ups on people that have done pieces that are illegal. And you're like, yeah, well done, man. Sick.
And that
30 seconds of fame. And then they disappear. And then all the graph's fucked, and they think that that's real graph.
Yo,
but really,
so
it's not.
Said that.
You know, and most of these kids are well-off middle-class dicks.
I have to say that you've just put a finer point on it, and that I've seen happen in Brighton.
Yeah, it all got destroyed with throw-ups, and it's not any one specific person.
It's just the culture.
I think it's important to have a good hand style. I think it's important to have a good throw-up. I think it's important to be able to do straight letters, dubs, complex pieces, characters. I personally give everything a go, and anyone who says that I don't do that, obviously looking at what I've done, and I'm not criticizing any one thing. The only thing I'm criticizing is people that claim to be something or something massive in graph when they only do one thing. And in that, I mean, anyone who only does throw-ups is no better than someone who they're just as guilty as the people that only do wild styles or only do complex burners. Have got the most terrible hand style and can't do a good throw up. You know, I think you've got, you know, again, we can talk about the Bible or the textbook of graph. We can go back to Star Wars, where Min is talking about you can't call yourself a king unless you do everything. Mm. You've got to be able to do every aspect, I think. How did we get on this rant? You're just drawing me in, aren't you?
Yeah,
all the time.
Controversy. No, your exhibition went down well, though. You know, I didn't make it, unfortunately, but there were enough people that were there. How did it go for you? How was that?
Oh, man, the whole place was just as like tumbleweed waiting for you to turn up. You know, there was just like kids crying and that.
Crying,
I got a violin. All the violins
Bibles
are out.
Coming out
they were like, shit, where's Keller? This place can't pop off until he's here.
That's it. Shut shop.
No, it was terrible. It was absolutely packed and format DJ'd, and Danny and so Matt the Hat DJ'd, and I sold every painting. So it was dreadful.
Get in, come on.
Well, you know,
it's love it.
Hard game, isn't it?
So I need one. I still need a piece, man.
Yeah, you better find some deep pockets then, son.
Yeah, I know, son. I know. Is this the NFT game which you're starting up? Is it NFT as well?
Yeah, I've been doing NFTs. But again, that's it. It's one of those things, isn't it? People can say, oh, it's this, it's that. It is what it is. Mm. And it is, if it's a hustle, if someone says, oh yeah, well, we're not going into town and stealing champagne anymore, we're going to steal this, people get onto the new scam, don't you? Mm. Oh, I've got a new way of scamming Oyster cards. I've got a new way of doing this. I've got a new... Well, there's a new way of scamming money out of graft, so have a go at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have a go at it and fail, then at least you had a go. If you have a go at it and succeed, you can sit there laughing.
Is this Viva La Vandal, for instance? Like, so what's the theory?
Viva La Vandal started off as a clothing company.
Okay.
But more importantly than that, it's a friendship between me and Spencer.
Gotcha.
Urber 81, one of the coolest guys ever.
Contact.
And you know what I mean? We've diversified that into a million different things. So
cool,
eventually there'll be Viva La Vandal skins that you wear in the metaverse, and people won't even realise that Viva La Vandal's still a clothing company. And if people want Viva La Vandal T-shirts, still make them, you know. But we've shifted our focus into other things. You know, we're doing all different stuff with in the NFT place and all this. It's. I don't really understand all of it, but all I know is we get paid for it. So
it doesn't matter.
So it doesn't really matter. Yeah, maybe I could, you know, organise it and make more. But I've never been greedy. I'm just happy to go, all right, cool. So I do this drawing, we turn it into that, and then that turns into that. All right, cool, we'll do it.
How about this? Because the one I see on Instagram, these Lamborghini wraps and the... Is that a Viva La Vandal thing? How do you
Yeah,
go
that's
about
Viva La Vandal
that?
As well. So, again, I don't know how much I should really talk about. I can't talk about the details.
No.
But obviously, we did the McLaren.
Yeah.
And we'd already had a preliminary conversation with Lambo. And then when the McLaren was unveiled and we showed what we'd done with it, Lamborghini messaged me instantly and said, we've got a problem. And I said, yeah, we have. Because if your Lambos are parked outside Harrods... And my McLaren that I've done's parked next to them. No one's looking at your Lambos. And they said, yeah, we know. That's the problem. So then, and I've said to them, you know, you're the only company with enough nerve to do it. Mm. I said, because it wouldn't suit any of the other brands. You know, you're known for being ostentatious and wild and street. You know, you're like, it's like the street dream, isn't it? Have a Lambo, drive down Streatham High Road and a Lambo. Yeah. You wouldn't want to do that.
No, blinding.
But you know, it's all the places I mentioned in South London.
Mm.
It's weird, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. It's
not
that.
Even from there.
Yeah, I know. But you seem to know them very well.
Must be geography.
Diversity is key, and we've always seen that in our, haven't we? Always seen.
Well, I just think that if you take the mentality of a graph writer, which you've got to use all these different things. You've got to do what you want to do without getting spotted. You've got to do it as much as you can and get as much fame as you can without getting caught. You've got to get your paint. You've got to do all these different things. Yeah. You've got all these different skills you've learned, but then don't apply them to anything else. So if you can apply all those different things to adult life...
I agree. And yeah, you're winning.
Yeah, people basically have already been to the toughest college in the world, the School of Graph.
Yeah, yeah.
So apply it to... And the other thing is, where's too many people are too quick to hate and get angry and get frustrated. Whereas, like, say, for example, when you talk about NFTs, the first thing I did to do with NFT, right? Sir from Graffiti Kings.
Hold tight, sir.
Woo. Yep. He says to me, right, you've got to go and paint this thing that looks like a green chickpea, but you've got to do a time lapse. I said, bro, that's going to take me 15 minutes. It's like... It's ridiculous. He's going, I don't care if it takes you 15 minutes. All black, put gloves on, did everything, had my back turned so you couldn't see who it was, painted this thing, filmed it, sent the thing off, got the money. So I'm like, bro, send me some more of them. We've mugged that guy off. If you want any more of them doing, I'm doing them. So I got paid the money to do that, and I'm thinking, you know, I've had that over. And then I said to him, you know, we've had that guy over. He said, no, bro. He said, he's had that little video clip made into a loop. He's minted it, sold it for 10 grand. So I was like, well, how did he do that? And he said, it's an NFT. And this was a year ago. So I'm like, do I get angry that I got paid this amount, which was still a fair amount of money for 15 minutes work?
Yeah, yeah.
Do I get angry about that? Or do I use this as, cool, someone's just given me that amount of money to learn a lesson about something?
It's true, isn't it?
So instead of being frustrated,
I like that, yeah.
I got paid for a lesson, so then I had to go out of my way and learn what NFTs were. Mm. And I still don't fully understand it, but I understand it enough. And you know, we've minted quite a few and sold quite a few. And then what we've done is, for the people that have bought them, the ones which had slowed down in interest, we destroyed them. So thus it's creating the ones that have been bought have now become rarer. We're working on a whole sequence of projects with the Skrillionaire and all different people. So we're doing all different things within it. Mm. But again, always as Viva La Vandal. And we're working on another one that's even more mental.
Wow.
With all these carbon tokens.
Nice. So,
but again, this isn't a door that is closed for everybody. This door is open for everybody.
It's all about how
you have to walk through it.
Want
to
do it, yeah.
Yeah.
And one thing that you've always stressed, even to me for a long time I met you, is you're a student.
You're always a student. Bro, I'm not special. Mm. I'm just a regular idiot that's just out there using... If I see something, there's an opportunity over there, I'll take it.
Mm-mm-mm-mm.
You know, and everyone should do that. And my advice would be to anybody is, everything you want to do, don't wait, just go and do it.
Just go and do it.
I wanted to go and paint with the best writers in America. Mm. So how do you do that? Go there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Go there. Put together a crew of people you know that you can rely on, like Wrenchy.
Big up Wrench.
You knew that was coming.
Big up Wrench. My God.
You know... Go with Batman. Wrench, go with Odyssey, go with Gary,
yeah.
Go with all the different people that you know that you can deal with, you know, and then we went again and again and again.
Mm.
But you go with the right people, it's all going to work.
Yeah, it's all going to work.
Yeah. And this is how these things happened. No one gave me a gold ticket and said, go and do that. Mm. You have to make it happen. Wanted to do the New York subway, get on the plane, go there, do the New York subway.
Mm.
You know, you want to go to all these different places, go and do it.
Yeah, do it.
Yeah, don't talk about it and don't whinge about it.
Sit on a sofa.
Yeah.
The internet will not bring you to the place.
No.
You go to the place.
I mean, that's the whole thing, isn't it? You get kids now playing the internet thinking that they're as good at skateboarding as Tony Hawk. You're as good at playing computer games. You're not actually any good at skateboarding.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same with everything.
Yeah, it is.
You're not a participant or a contributor. You're a consumer.
That's how you see scenes. That's how you get into the culture. That's how you become a part of a scene and you elevate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just think, and the like other thing as well is all the time when people are asleep, not doing anything, there's people somewhere else that are doing it.
Oh, so, like, I love that.
You know, the whole thing of like, you want to be terrified by graffiti. Go to Russia, see how
they do it.
There's graffiti, Russian graffiti writers you've never heard of that will blow your mind how good they are, like terrifyingly good.
But
they're
there,
and there's hundreds of them
in the snow.
They're just in the most harshest conditions. Yeah. They've got nothing else. And they're just like that. I'm going to burn the world down at Graf.
Mm.
And eventually they'll appear and you'll just be like, where the hell did this person come from? It's like, well, they were doing it the whole time. You just weren't looking.
Yeah.
And it's dedicated. The same. Yeah. Mm. The same in the end. There'll be graffiti writers coming out of China in the end that just burn everybody.
Everything. If they ain't doing it already in breakdancing, they're about to...
Oh, man. Oh, well, let's talk about, you know, you want to talk about... When the Koreans... This isn't even new. It's all... Everyone's seen it. The Koreans destroyed everybody at break-in.
Destroyed it.
The Russians came and destroyed them.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's just a cycle. Everything runs in cycles. The same with the Brighton graffiti. At the moment, Brighton graffiti is on a down. Mm. Eventually, it will rise again.
It
always does. It's risen before, it's dipped, it's risen again. It keeps... Same with London graffiti. All goes in cycles.
Mm.
Everything is a cycle. And you just have to understand it all.
Any regrets?
Well, yeah, I should never have said how much money I earned from that thing.
No, I don't mean immediate regrets.
Oh,
coming on podcasts, I'm talking about...
I don't regret that. I obviously regret waffling a bit too much, where I think sometimes I could be more succinct in my points.
That's some...
That's just no. I'll be honest with you. I think anyone who knows me knows that I'm generally quite a kind person, so I don't really regret anything like that. Anyone who's ever had anything bad to say about me either A, doesn't know me, or B, has done something to solicit that response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So no regrets really. I mean, you could sit and say, "Oh, I wish I'd done more graph when I was younger," and. You know, this yard would have been well easy back then. Yeah, of course it would have been. But you weren't in that frame of mind or that space to do that.
I think that's
then.
The biggest thing with a lot of the older generations of graffiti writers that come in here. The biggest after conversations that we have is they do regret not
doing more
when they could have done with least.
Yeah, but let's talk about some of the absolute G's from back then who, without saying any names, just as active now.
Yeah, yeah,
still
true.
Smashing it. So nothing but respect going out to that man.
1,000%. 1,000%.
One of the nicest old school guys ever.
100%. Exactly who you mean.
Yeah, and if you're watching this podcast and don't know who we mean, doesn't really matter.
You haven't really been paying attention to any podcasts.
Yeah, you need to get him on.
It's been a pleasure having you on.
Are we done already?
We're done already for another one. That was perfect.
Yeah, well, it's always been nice, isn't it? A little outpouring. I wonder if it's very interesting, though, for people listening at home.
I don't know. Comment below.
What a nerd.
The nerd has come out of you on this one. I've got to say, it's very good. It's been very good. But the gold teeth make up for it.
Do you reckon? Does that keep me straight?
It's kept you to the straight and narrow. Thank you so much, Arrow.
Respect, brother.
Legend, my brother. Killer Keller Podcast, out like him was out of fashion. You know what it do every week. Sharing his care, all right? Don't talk to anyone I wouldn't. Stay lucky. Peace.